Okay, let's unpack this. We've been talking about the future of work for years, but what if the entire foundation of how we measure talent, that traditional qualification-centric system, is just fundamentally broken?
It really is. It's a system rooted in the 20th century trying to solve 21st century problems.
So today, we're diving deep into the global imperative for a skills-first approach. We're looking at sources that argue this shift isn't optional anymore. It's essential for economic survival, especially for you navigating the next 5 years of your career.
It's absolutely critical. And the thing that defines the urgency now is just the sheer speed of change. I mean, we're facing technological disruption, demographic shifts.
Geopolitical fragmentation, too.
Right. All of it exposes the limits of relying on old credentials. Our sources highlight some pretty staggering figures from the World Economic Forum. They predict 22% of current jobs will be transformed between 2025 and 2030.
22%. That's significant. But here's the stat that always, stops me cold. 40% of core job skills are expected to change by 2030. Think about that for a moment. If you invested heavily in a specialized degree today, in just a few years, almost half of what you learned could be outdated.
That anxiety is real. And it's exactly why the traditional system is failing. The core challenge isn't just about training more people, it's about closing what the paper calls the transformation gap.
And what defines that gap exactly?
Well, it's this kind of simultaneous skills crisis. So, on one hand, we have severe shortages in emerging domains.
Right, we can't find people for AI, data, green skills.
Exactly. But on the other hand, we have this massive skills underutilization among displaced workers. These are people with perfectly relevant capabilities, but they're hidden because the system doesn't recognize them outside of their old job titles.
So we have the people, but the system can't connect their actual skills to the new jobs.
The connections are broken.
That structural failure is the crux of it. The sources lay out five inefficiencies. We hear these terms a lot. Signaling failures, coordination deficits. What else?
Risk asymmetry, measurement gaps, and cultural resistance. Let's just focus on two because they really hit home. What is a signaling failure?
Okay, yeah.
A signaling failure is when a job ad asks for a four-year degree when the job genuinely just needs three specific technical skills. The degree is a loud signal, but it's an inaccurate one.
And it filters out great candidates who learn those skills on the job.
Exactly. The signal is weak and noisy.
That's a daily frustration. Okay, what about risk asymmetry?
This one really hurts small employers. So investing in training is risky. If a small business pays thousands to upskill an employee
That employee can just get poached by a bigger company.
who didn't pay for any of the training, the risk isn't shared fairly, so employers just don't invest. It makes the skills gap worse.
That makes perfect sense. So, our mission in this deep dive is to unpack how these skills-first principles can be embedded across the entire policy ecosystem, industrial, labor, and skills policy to create one unified system.
It's about making capability, not credentials, the organizing logic, a
Yeah.
reorientation towards precision.
Let's start with defining that precision. What exactly is the skills-first approach?
At its core, it's the systematic practice of identifying, validating, developing, and deploying skills as the main currency for the labor market.
The primary currency.
Yeah. Instead of talking about vague talent shortages, we use precision tools to target specific capability gaps. It turns abstract training dollars into strategic investment.
So, if skills are the new currency, you need a system to support it. The sources talk about three foundational pillars. What's the first one?
The first foundation is establishing skills as a common language. Imagine trying to trade stocks if everyone used different names for the same company. It would be chaos.
Okay.
This requires standardized, machine-readable taxonomies. They map jobs to tasks to skills across all sectors. It gives everyone a shared vocabulary.
That sounds like a massive undertaking. I mean, almost bureaucratic. How do you actually create this common language?
It is complex, but it's essential. Look at the European system, ESCO. It links almost 14,000 skills with over 3,000 occupations. It transforms fuzzy ideas like good communication into something precise.
Like proficient in cross-cultural negotiation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or ability to draft effective policy memos, actionable descriptions.
That level of detail is key to avoiding that signaling failure we talked about. And that leads right into foundation two. Skills as a validated signal. It's not enough to speak the language. People have to trust it.
Precisely. You need trusted mechanisms to recognize skills no matter how they were acquired, formal education, on the job, a micro-credential. This validation infrastructure makes skills visible and portable.
And it gives the employer confidence. The UK's Energy Skills Passport is a great real-world example of this.
It is. It's a central registry. It captures your employment history and certified, verified skills for the energy sector. It's like a digital passport, a single source of truth for your capabilities.
But I have to push back on this. If these systems exist, why aren't they everywhere? You mentioned a critique about adoption.
That's where the rubber meets the road. The sources noted that in places like Malaysia, employer awareness of this stuff, recognizing prior experience, is still really low.
So if employers are still stuck in the old habit of just asking for a degree,
then the validated signal fails, no matter how good the system is. Policy has to drive that demand-side adoption.
Got it. Okay, third foundation. Skills as a dynamic asset. If 40% of skills are changing every few years, we can't see them as static.
Right. They have to be treated like evolving assets that need continuous development. This means skills management has to move from being an HR compliance item to a strategic business asset.
And Singapore has a tool for this, right? Talent Track.
Yes, Talent Track. It lets companies review their current skill stock and then proactively plan for reskilling based on where their business is going. It's skills intelligence for the C-suite, not just HR.
So we have the building blocks, but moving from foundations to actual policy means changing ingrained habits across government. Skills, labor, industrial policy, they all operate in these frustrating silos.
You have to break those silos down.
Yeah.
And you do that by transforming the core mandate of each one, starting with industrial policy.
Industrial policy is usually about big investments, right? Tax breaks, subsidies, attracting factories.
Exactly. Traditionally, it's just about job creation, about headcount. Skills First shifts this to capability development mandates.
Meaning?
Meaning you condition those big investments on an employer's commitment to develop domestic skills capabilities, you're saying.
Mm.
If we invest in you, you have to measurably invest in our local talent.
So if the government funds a new factory, it's only if that factory commits to creating skills pathways for local workers. Can you give an example of how that funding gets tied to both the business and the workforce?
Look at Singapore's Skills Future Enterprise Credit. You don't just get the money for any old training. It's unlocked only if you invest in two things at once. Enterprise transformation, so redesigning your business, and workforce transformation.
Training employees for that new business model.
Correct. The subsidy links the business strategy directly to the skill strategy.
And this needs to extend beyond just one company, right? To stop the big firms from hoarding all the advanced skills.
That's where you get value chain capability mandates. Singapore's PASSEP scheme is a prime example. It co-funds knowledge transfer from big companies to their small, local suppliers. That includes funding training for the supplier's employees. It deepens the skills across the whole ecosystem.
Okay, so that's industrial policy. Moving on to labor policy. This has traditionally been about a safety net, protection, income support between jobs.
With Skills First, you transform this from a defensive mechanism to one that supports proactive mobility. It's about making career transitions low friction and skills-based.
And we're seeing AI platforms that help with this.
We are. Platforms like Pinpoint and GapJumpers. They screen candidates based on demonstrated skills and competencies, not where they went to school. They prioritize what you can do over your old job title.
And for the individual worker, we need them to have agency over their own skills. That's where those portable digital skills accounts come in.
Yes, the portable skills accounts, they're like digital skills wallets. They pull in and certify your competencies from all over courses, old jobs, even military service. The Europass digital credential is one. Singapore's Careers and Skills Passport is another.
So your skills become a truly portable asset you own.
Exactly. And for those times when industries shrink, we have transition mapping tools.
This is so important.
It's vital. An organization in the U.S., Opportunity at Work, has the Star Mobility Compass. It analyzes a worker's existing skills, what they call skills that are routinely acquired, and then it identifies low-friction pathways to new jobs.
So it shows you jobs where you already have, say, 70% of the skills you need.
Precisely. It shifts the focus from just income maintenance to targeted transition and capability activation.
Okay, finally, let's look at skills policy. Traditionally, this is just about expanding training capacity. More colleges, more classes.
Skills First moves this mandate toward targeted capability building. The shift is from just expanding supply to making strategic investments based on granular intelligence.
Precision upskilling.
Yes, precision upskilling. You use real-time intelligence to target investments where skills gaps are actually holding back the national economy. Cambodia's digital economy framework is a great illustration of this. They didn't just say more IT, they prioritized specific in-demand digital competencies.
And this leads to building out clear pathways for people.
It does. Skills-based progression pathways. Singapore's Skills and Job Mobility Dashboard helps people who are thinking about a career change. It shows them the transferable skills they already have and the exact training they need to make the leap.
But this whole system lives or dies on the quality of its intelligence.
Absolutely. Dynamic forecasting is key. Platforms like Australia's Jobs and Skills Atlas provide integrated data from the national down to the regional level. It lets you be proactive, not reactive, with training. It ensures public money flows to high-impact, future-proof opportunities.
This makes it so clear that individual companies or workers can't do this alone. The government has a huge role to play here. The sources point to 7 crucial roles.
Systemic change means the government has to be the architect. It has to play multiple roles at once. The first is integrator and policy coordinator. This means forcing coherence across all ministries, labor, education, industry. They have to work as one.
But that's notoriously difficult. How do you actually institutionalize that kind of cooperation?
It's the challenge. But nations that succeed, like Germany with its national skills strategy, they bring everyone to the table. Federal ministries, state governments, employers, unions, they build a structure that forces continuous coordination.
Okay, the second role is convener and standard setter. This goes back to our first foundation, that common language.
Correct. Government has to lead the development of national skills taxonomies. Jobs and skills. Australia is doing this right now, creating a national skills taxonomy to improve mobility across the whole country.
They also have to be the systems and capability builder. Only the government can really fund and maintain that underlying digital infrastructure.
That's where the big investment goes. You see this in Denmark's Jobindsats portal. It provides public dashboards on skills shortages for local job centers, putting data-driven tools directly in their hands.
Role 4, quality regulator. You need trust in these new micro-credentials.
This is critical for fighting cultural resistance. New Zealand's framework doesn't just recognize micro-credentials, it integrates them into the National Qualifications Framework. They're subject to the same quality assurance as a degree. That gives them immediate legitimacy.
And finally, the government has to be the exemplar adopter. They have to practice what they preach.
For sure. Implementing skills-based hiring in the public sector builds market confidence overnight. Singapore's Public Service Division now supports it. With most job ads no longer requiring specific degrees, they evaluate you on validated competencies. It sets the standard.
It's fantastic to see these examples, but implementation is always the bottleneck. The paper had a helpful framework for this, the readiness to adoption framework. How does that help prioritize?
It's a strategic roadmap. Okay. It shows that some things, like dynamic forecasting or building a skills validation infrastructure, require high coordination and high technical capabilities. They're long-term projects.
Big lifts.
Big lifts. But others, like skills-linked incentives, you know, subsidies tied to training, require less coordination. You can deploy those sooner to start changing behavior. It encourages a phased approach.
And looking at the early adopters, what are the core institutional lessons that really stand out?
3 clear lessons. Yeah. First, coordinated skills intelligence. Integrated data, like in Australia and Singapore, massively strengthens the system's responsiveness. Yeah. You can't hit a target you can't see.
Second, multi-stakeholder governance. That tripartite mechanism, government, employers, unions, is non-negotiable. Places like Norway, Sweden, and Cambodia show that co-designing reforms ensures they're trusted and relevant.
And the third lesson, which is often the silent killer of reforms, is stable long-term policy commitments. Volatility kills investment. Germany, Singapore, Sweden, they all show that long-term policy reduces risk for employers so they can plan workforce development with certainty.
This whole deep dive really shows that moving to skills first isn't just incremental reform, it is systemic transformation. It requires that policy coherence across the industrial, labor, and skills nexus.
It's about aligning those mandates and realizing the system isn't failing for a lack of effort, but for a fundamental lack of alignment and, well, shared language. We have to redefine what success even looks like in the 21st century labor market.
So we'll leave you with the core challenges facing all policymakers seeking this transition, drawing directly from the paper's final questions. How can policies strengthen market signals and reduce those adoption barriers, like cultural resistance, so that investments in workforce capabilities are driven by genuine business value and not just a compliance exercise?
And crucially, Who is ultimately accountable for making sure that skills, industrial, and labor strategies stop operating in parallel and actually function as one coherent system? That definition of shared accountability, that is the final frontier in achieving a truly skills-first economy.